Okay. Actually, could you just sort of state your name and your age for me?
My name is Darren Fisher. I'm 30 years old.
Great. And what do you do here at Google?
Well, I work on Firefox, primarily. I work on other things related to Firefox, and I help other teams who are trying to work with Firefox. Or to, you know, there's various things that Google's done to extend Firefox. We've published about 5 extensions, I believe, from the Google toolbar to an anti-phishing extension to various other things that are meant to sort of, you know, make Firefox more attractive to users.
Mm-hmm.
So I with my experience having worked on Mozilla, I try to help other folks here who are trying to build extensions to Firefox, in addition to just contributing directly to Firefox.
And how long have you worked on Mozilla projects, or how did you come to work on Mozilla projects?
So it started for me by going to work for AOL, and I started working on it in Dulles on a little small team who was basically trying to embed the Mozilla rendering engine into a client product that they were building. And through that, I learned about Mozilla for the first time. And shortly, though, after that, I found out that there was a job opportunity at Netscape on the West Coast. And I really wanted to come back to California because I had gone to school out in California. So I didn't stay out in Dulles for very long. I was only there for about 3 months before making the switch. And so then I joined Netscape. At the time, they were already owned by AOL. And I found out that there were several different types of teams that I could work for. And one was like work on the front end, work on the AOL instant messaging component of the Netscape communicator. One was go work on the networking engine of the Gecko rendering system. And that one was more attractive to me because not knowing very much at all about Mozilla, but having experience with operating system level APIs, I felt like I could contribute to the networking layer. And the manager who was involved was, you know, seemed like a really sharp guy who I wanted to work for, so I went and worked with them.
Great. So what are all of the Mozilla projects that you've worked on?
Well, so for the beginning, I focused on the networking layer, and
mm-hmm.
I moved from being, you know, sort of a newbie to becoming module owner for the networking layer. So now it's just sort of taking on more responsibility in that area. And so I continue to sort of look over it, but mostly it's maintenance kind of job. And so more recently, I worked on the auto update system for Firefox. That sort of was my primary project last year. Before that, I worked on a lot of different sort of things like enhancing integration points with the operating system. For instance, for Firefox 1.0, I worked on adding support for advanced authentication in the browser. A lot of people who are at companies sort of take for granted that Internet Explorer is able to authenticate them to their corporate network. They don't realize that there's some fancy authentication going on there. And Firefox has always been sort of shut out because we didn't support that kind of authentication. And so worked with people in the community. A guy from Sandia Labs helped a lot. And we, you know, made that happen for Firefox 1.0. It was sort of a small thing that nobody probably noticed, but because I felt like it just took away one more barrier to entry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned you're a module owner or a leader.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Well, so in the Mozilla world, basically, it's really important that we find people who care about particular areas of the code, and it's too much for one person to understand everything that's going on, so it's broken up into modules. And so what ends up happening is if somebody's very interested in a particular area and they can sort of take ownership of it, meaning kind of watch out for what's best for that area of the code, watch out, monitor contributions, help review contributions, help assist other people make contributions in that area, and do so in a way that's good for the whole project, that's sort of consistent with where we want to take the project. Try not to introduce too much risk when we're trying to do a release, things of that sort. So basically, people tend to take module ownership basically in a more ad hoc fashion. It's sort of a matter of whoever takes interest in, and whoever, you know, sort of decides that they really want to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that really...
Yeah, but are you thought of as the supervisor of...
Yeah, I think that's the way you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody had issue with sort of... They wanted to do something with the Mozilla networking layer, they would be advised to talk to me or
mm-hmm.
people who I've worked with in that area, because... And same goes for other areas of the code. You know, if I wanted to work on JavaScript, I would want to go talk to Brendan Eich, you know, because that's his area of the code, and he knows it best. He'd be able to advise me the quickest.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of loosely how the Mozilla project's organized. At the development level, it's just sort of a collection of module owners and peers who are working with them,
mm-hmm.
people who have demonstrated that they, you know, basically have leadership qualities enough to try to keep things cohesive across the project.
Great. How do you generally communicate with the people who you work with in your groups?
Email, instant messaging, and that sort. Basically, when I say email, though, there's a lot of different sort of things that are similar, like, you know, mailing lists where we're emailing to, you know, broadcast out to the community. We have a bug system, which is sort of like a bulletin board, if you will. It's
mm-hmm.
it's for tracking defects, but it's also for tracking feature enhancements. And so that's a way of sort of doing project management in a distributed fashion. The bugs are sort of numbered so people can find, you know, that's how you find a certain topic. But then from there, it branches out and you get, you know, people commenting about all the different things pertaining to that bug or feature request. And that ends up being quite a central point for communication. And then, you know, obviously instant messaging is really important for that sort of immediate kind of, hey, look, what are we going to do about this kind of thing, so you can get that interactivity with the other developers. And so we have an IRC
mm-hmm.
server that's hosted by Mozilla.org, and that's sort of the central place where everybody's logged on, not always at the same time, but generally that's a great place to find out, to talk to people directly.
Mm-hmm. Ben mentioned before that he thought it was important that a lot of this communication be archived.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
so
that there's like efforts.
One of the things that's always been a problem is that too much decision making has happened in IRC. Too much decision making has happened in private emails, such that for new people to the project, it looks like it's unclear how decisions are made. It's unclear how one contributes. It's unclear how one gets involved. You can't look to the past and say that's how they did it, because it's not archived.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, Ben has been a big proponent recently of trying to get people to use the mailing list where things are archived, or to use the news groups where things are archived, or to put things on blogs, on wikis. And I say in the last year, I didn't mention this when you asked about communication, but wikis have become a big, big, big communication tool for the project. Because
mm-hmm.
unlike a mailing list, where it gets sort of, things get lost as the thread grows in size and it becomes hard to understand what was originally being discussed. And it's hard to do revisions in a mailing list. It's easy to have a back-to-forth conversation and go down a tangent in a mailing list. But wikis are great because in parallel to mailing lists, you can have the wiki where you're revising that document that you're discussing in the mailing list. And so you can always check back and say, oh, this is the latest state of that wiki document. Here's how it evolved over here in this mailing list.
Mm-hmm.
I found that this works out really well. The wiki has been an invaluable tool for enabling us to build out better design documentation and developer documentation.
Mm-hmm.
Before, I guess, you know, even though we had a documentation system that involved using the source code repository tools, CVS and whatnot, that was just too much of a barrier for people.
Hmm.
And so we had a lot of really old documentation that was incomplete and incorrect that would, again, be a big problem for new users, new developers, new contributors.
Hmm. Right. Would you say that strict ownership of specific areas of code are enforced?
Not really. It has a lot to do with sort of the module owners,
mm-hmm.
How involved are they? And a lot of times people come and go from the project, and module owners come and go. The problem is that, like with many things, if there's not somebody there to go sort of tidy things up, you have a lot of leftover cruft. And so you have people who are on paper as module owners or on the websites as their module owner, but they're not really involved in the project anymore. And so it takes people who are involved in the project to say who's actually still involved, and people don't really keep that up to date, and so that can be a problem. But
how do those transitions occur when there's someone who's kind of gone inactive, and then, you know,
the most successful ways to make change happen. I mean, basically, somebody has to be aggressive and assertive and just take the bull by the horns and say, this is what I'm going to do. I think this is a good idea. And by and large, you know, if that old module owner's not around anymore, then it doesn't matter because they don't care anymore. They're not part of the picture. They haven't been involved. They're not involved. So if somebody steps in and says they want to take over, then other people still involved in the project will say, great, finally, somebody who is going to care about that area of the code.
And so, in effect, they're promoted to be the module owner?
Right. So there is sort of a hierarchy where ultimately, like, Brendan Eich is sort of our sort of the overarching kind of father figure for the project at the developer level. Like, you know, he'll make the final say on things like that. He'll say, yes, I think this is a good idea. You know, there's only a few people, he and maybe one other person has actually privileges to change that document that actually says who the module owners are. But basically it comes down to him and a few other people that he might consult with, and then basically just sort of what's popular opinion amongst the module owners who are active.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an example? Maybe you can give us an example of when that's happened.
Sure.
How
the best example
out.
Would be like when Netscape went away. So this problem didn't seem to exist as much, although it did when Netscape was active, because Netscape paid people to fill in all the slots on the paper to say, yes, we have somebody on part X, Y, and Z. Yes, we have a QA engineer on part X, Y, and Z, module X, Y, and Z. even if those people weren't actually very effective in those roles, there was somebody who was designated to be in those roles. When Netscape left the project, when AOL dissolved the Netscape client team, we were left with, on paper, those same people. And some of those people continued to stay involved because it was an open source project. Maybe they still cared about it, right? But there we had a whole bunch of stale contributors who were no longer involved. And it's really interesting. So at the same time, Firefox 1.0 was starting the development cycle. This was, you know, a year before Firefox 1.0 about. And new people started to get involved because they were getting excited about Phoenix or Firebird or whatever it was called time, and they started to recognize, oh, look, there's a problem area. Nobody's taking care of that area of the code. There's a crap load of bugs accumulating in that area, and nobody's taking care of it, and so they'll jump in and take it, and it just grows organically like that. You know, suddenly people are filling in the holes, and, you know, it's evolving into not such a problem anymore. With the QA situation, we've never gotten back to a state where we actually have QA module owners like we used to at Netscape. In fact, it's gotten to the point now where in the bug system, if you look at who is the QA contact for a bug, it's no longer a person, but rather a fake email address that actually, or like a mailing list email address, so that anybody interested in that category of bugs can just sort of watch bugs that are assigned to that dummy QA address. Details, but the point is that the system has evolved from where it was at Netscape, where there was much more structure in terms of who was quote-unquote responsible, to a system where it's more dynamic in that whoever takes ownership has ownership.
Hmm.
Which is much more healthy, in my opinion, because at Netscape there was all this false ownership, I felt like, and that caused a lot of problems because you say, well, aren't you responsible? Well, you know, sometimes people didn't carry their weight, but because of the hierarchy at Netscape and everything, it's sort of, you know, I don't know how to explain it. It's like, you know, the company wanted to basically fill out all the positions and make sure that people were there, but that didn't mean that they were the most effective.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're in a position where only people who care about the project are contributing. And so we're getting more effective contributors, not just people who are contributing because they're getting a salary.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever clashed with any other developer over a particular point of code?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Can you kind of describe how you resolve those disputes?
Sometimes they're not well resolved. And sometimes the disputes are small enough that it doesn't matter. Oftentimes when the dispute is significant enough, logic wins. You know, and oftentimes, you know, the kinds of disputes that happen, they tend to stem from misunderstandings or people not having all the information. And that's almost always the case. You know, somebody will say something that sounds absurd to the other person, but that's because that other person doesn't have all the information that the other person has. And people aren't always the most patient when they want to explain it. So if you're looking for like specific examples, maybe. I can give you a specific trivial example.
Sure, yeah, that's great.
Well, more recently, there was sort of a... Actually, I don't know how trivial this is. I was having a debate with another engineer about whether or not we should drop support for Windows 95, 98, and Windows ME. And technically, there's a lot of additional work that's required to support those older versions of Windows. And our understanding is that very few of our users actually are on those older systems. Perhaps Firefox attracts people who also will have more modern operating systems installed on their computers, you know, more tech-savvy folk. But nonetheless, maybe 2 to 3% of our users are on old versions of Windows. So I said to him, well, if maybe it's too difficult for us, for Firefox 3 now, this is a year out, to say maybe for Firefox 3 it's too difficult for us to support Windows 98 because we're changing some of the subsystems in such a way that it would be a lot of work to try to continue to support Windows 98. So maybe it's too difficult for us, but what if somebody came along and blessed us with a patch and said, here you go, here's Windows 98 support. What would you do? Because this developer was actually wanting to actively remove code that did support Windows 98, even though the whole project the whole Firefox 3 right now in the development version does not support Windows 98 because a certain chunk is missing. There's still a large bit of code that's in there to support Windows 98. So he wanted to remove that bit, and I was against it. I was saying, why remove it if it's there? Why not let somebody come along and contribute that missing piece that we've gone and broken support for Windows 98? Maybe somebody would want to come and add support for it. And he argued, well, it could be done in a different way. It could be done as a shim that in such a way that our code is completely looks as though it doesn't support Windows 98 at all. And I said, well, that sort of puts a lot of extra burden on that guy who wants to support Windows 98 to the point where maybe he won't even want to do it. But he was very adamant that he didn't want his code to have all this ugly code, what he described as very unclean and ugly code that tries to support Windows 98. And so this is sort of a point of contention where, you know, I'm sort of on the... I feel like that 2 or 3% of users might be significant enough that it's worth it to us. Even though, you know, maybe it's not. But when I started the argument with him, I didn't realize that he had sort of an alternate idea of how Windows 98 could be supported that maybe is not so unreasonable. And so, He felt like he had said all these things before, so he was very not interested in having the discussion. So it made it hard for me to ask questions to him because he would be quite reluctant to sort of be patient and explain his thoughts. And so,
And you work primarily on the rendering engine.
I guess yeah, I work on components of the rendering engine. I actually don't work on sort of anything having to do with actually laying out frames on the page and, you know, sort of anything that's actually rendering. I work on sort of the support for the rendering engine, such as the networking layer, such as various sort of low-level subsystems that are used by the rendering engine to provide sort of the cross-platform base on which it's built.
And what kind of interests you about that work?
Well, like
most?
For instance, I find that Firefox has got something very unique, which is a application platform that is completely cross-platform. Completely, it sort of allows you to build very rich applications, GUI applications that are independent of what operating system you're running on. The fact that Thunderbird is built off the same technology, the fact that numerous other applications are cropping up that are built on the same technology, the fact that we can so easily deploy extensions to Firefox for all three platforms, you realize the Google Toolbar for Firefox is the very first product from Google that supports Windows, Linux, and Mac all at the same time, and in multiple languages all at the same time. And that's because the Mozilla platform makes it, A, extremely easy to target multiple operating systems and computer architectures, B, extremely easy to localize. Localization is easier in the Mozilla platform than any other toolkit I could imagine for building applications, because, and this is getting technical, it not only makes it very easy for you, for people who are non-technical, to change the strings and to author the to change the text that appears, it also makes it very easy for them to do so in a way such that the application itself sort of adjusts according to the size of the strings. This turns out to be a really a detail that causes all a lot of work for software engineers. When they localize, they find that the string is too long now, and then they have to go change some pixel parameters somewhere. And so somebody who's non-technical, who's like very good with converting English to Japanese, might have trouble with that, right? And they can't do it on their own. But in the Mozilla world, they can do it on their own, because the system is such that it dynamically adjusts the size of everything according to the size of text. Not only that, but if they do need to make tweaks to the way the UI is rendered, the kind of tweaks that they would make, it's sort of similar to tweaking a web page using the way HTML and CSS and JavaScript all come together to build web pages. Mozilla's application framework is very similar, and so it's very accessible to people who are non-technical.
What would you attribute that kind of flexibility to? Would you attribute it more to just the kind of happenstance or legacy of the code that was inherited from Netscape, or would you attribute it to the way in which Mozilla's developed?
So both, because so the thing about Netscape is that Netscape threw away their code, right? And what they decided to do was to start on this thing called Mozilla. Oh, sorry, the old thing was called Mozilla too, but they decided to start this new Mozilla, this Gecko thing. And part of the goal there was to say, look at this platform we've provided to web authors, web content authors. This platform allows them to deliver applications to any platform, and in this very compelling way that's very easy for new people to come in and play, because you can view the source of anybody's HTML. Like, the web is the largest open source project in the world. It's amazing. The fact that you can view the source of a web page in the browser is perhaps one of the things that, in my opinion, it allowed the web to grow the way it does, because anybody can go and look at the under the hood, and somebody who's like just starting out in their career, as a software engineer, can run with it, can grab things, they can see how, oh, they did this really neat thing on their web page, they can grab it and they can copy it and do all these great things. And so the people who were building Mozilla, they realized, we just built this thing that allows people inside this window to do just about everything in a cross-platform way. Why don't we extend it beyond that window? Why don't we use that sort of technology to actually build the application itself that's sitting on the guy's desktop? So it turns out, if you look at Firefox, it's really just inside the outer window, the window that's provided by Windows. Everything inside is really just a web page. It's just sort of nestings of web pages. And that technology, that decision back in 98 or 99 or whenever, those guys, I think that was such a brilliant move, because it's reusing the technology that drives the web platform to build the application framework. And so it's sort of a small step to go from this thing you've built in this content area out to this thing that now can drive actually full applications. Because it's, again, JavaScript based, again, content based. Like, instead of HTML, you have Zool. It's a very similar concept. CSS, again, to control sort of all the colors and themes and the style, and to give the artist their ability to draw, present the UI in the way they like. And so.
And so in that way, the technology lends itself
mm-hmm.
to independent development
mm-hmm.
by open
right.
source communities.
Right, I think so. I think it makes it sort of lowers the bar for people to build cross-platform applications. And I really, the challenge, though, is that unlike the web platform, this application platform is not as polished. I mean, it's so similar, and it's so close to being exactly what you want, but it suffers from many things. Like, it's not as well documented as that web platform. It's not as bug-free as that web platform. There's quirks. there's things where in order to get around to be successful, you have to get on that IRC channel and ask somebody. And that's a huge barrier to entry. So on one hand, it's like, technology-wise, it's like exactly the direction you want to be going, but it's like it's not finished. It's Netscape took it to the point where they could build a browser with it that had a mail program integrated in it, that had a website composition tool integrated in it. They took it to that point. They never finished it. And so even today, when my coworkers at Google are trying to build an extension, and they're like, how come this list box, you know, when I add an element inside this list box, it doesn't render unless I put some weird tag at the bottom that seems to have no relevance at all to the list box? And it's just some bug, you know? And it's like it took them 6 hours to figure out why that was needed and that it was needed and all that. And so people here are, you know, I think are exceptional software engineers, so they're able to have that kind of stamina. But I think a lot of people would run away, and I think a lot of people do. So it's really unfortunate that Netscape, you know, they didn't have the resources to take it all the way through to actually build a proper, complete, polished toolkit. But it's, time and time again, people get attracted to it, but then they get frustrated at the same time. So, you know, like, there's some effort at Mozilla and in the open source community now to try to take it to the next step, take it to the next level, I mean, and some other companies are starting to leverage that. Like, I guess you've heard of Songbird, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
So that's built on the Mozilla framework, Mozilla toolkit. And, you know, they were able to put together their application pretty easily. I know that their application, at least the first version that I tried, was not very good. Or, you know, had a lot of issues, but I think that they'll be able to work those things out. And so hopefully it'll be a success story for the Mozilla platform. You know, Flock came together as very quickly as an alternative browser. I've seen quite a few other sort of applications. Turns out my brother works for a company that created a health, sort of a standalone health application built on the Mozilla framework. He got involved using that technology because of me, I imagine, you know, he knew about it. I don't know if he would have known about it if he hadn't. But then I didn't sell it on him. You know, I just sort of suggested it to him, and he tried it. And at first he didn't want to go there because it seemed unpolished, and he went down another route using another toolkit. But that ended up having its own sort of issues, and he ended up scrapping that version and going back to the Mozilla platform and ended up with a shipping product. And he was very happy with it. Their company got acquired and so on. So I think that, you know, it's possible that in the future we're going to see more and more of these kinds of applications coming up that leverage Firefox's technology.
Do you think that there's working kind of on the back end, do you think that there's a difference in culture between the people who work on the back end and the people who work kind of on the user interface? And
certainly.
Do you have any sort of what's your sort of impression of the people who work on the other end?
Well, so one of the things is that because of this application toolkit is so accessible, because it's just since it's not a, it's mostly built without having to ever compile anything, that allows a lot of people who are not as strong with computer science to come in and participate. And sometimes those people can be, you know, like somebody who's a very good graphics designer who knows how to fiddle with HTML could actually be a very effective contributor to helping improve the Firefox UI. And we even have some folks here who are building extensions, but they're not C++ coders. They're not coders at that level who work with compiled languages, but they're very good at working with JavaScript, very good at working with the APIs at that level and building really compelling things. It's like they're masters of that domain. And so I think that there's a real difference between the people that work at the front end and the people who work at the back end. It's like the people who work at the back end, they tend to be people who really absorb themselves in the C++ world. and then, like I said, the people in the front end absorb themselves in the JavaScript world. Not as many people sort of go between.
So there's a boundary between,
sure,
between the two.
Sure.
And are there tensions across that boundary?
Well, what do you mean? Like what kinds?
Are there are do do conflicts arise between...
Sure,
between...
I mean, there's... Okay, yeah. So definitely there are potential for conflicts. Like, in some sense, Firefox is simply using Gecko and the Mozilla platform as a platform to build an application. And so Firefox as an application is really just interested in having that stable base or just having that thing that it's that's providing what it needs. And, you know, if that thing is sufficient, Firefox doesn't need anything else from it. And so they're going to build their application on top of it. But the people building that platform, they see Firefox as their vehicle to get that platform out there. And so they want to put things in that platform that make it compelling to in their mind. And so sometimes they're putting things in there that cause risk, because any change causes risk. And sometimes that's not exactly what the front-end people want, the people who are focused on building that application. And so we've always had this sort of tension. People have said, well, shouldn't we treat the back-end as a separate product with its own release cycle and let Firefox grab a stable snapshot and build off of that? And other people say, well, but Firefox is the only real vehicle for this platform. It's the main vehicle. And unless Firefox is constantly getting the latest version of the back-end, then the back-end's not getting any sort of constant testing. And so,
where do you fall on that?
Well,
debate.
No, I think that that's a compelling argument. I think we want to go to a world where we can have stable snapshots of the back of the platform. But what that requires is that we actually have a well-defined interface between the platform and the applications. And again, and sort of one of the problems with the Mozilla platform is that the interface is not well-defined. It's very broad, quite encompassing, and sort of it doesn't, and it sort of reveals all its inner details to the outside world. It's a very exposed interface, if you will, and so it makes it very easy for applications to come inside, twiddle with things that maybe the platform folk didn't expect people to twiddle with, but that introduces dependencies between the front end and the back end that then become very difficult to sever and make it such that the back end and the front end need to march together in lockstep, otherwise things fall apart. So it then becomes a tremendous effort to decouple them, and maybe not so worth it.
Okay. To what extent do you think Mozilla has relied on the work of volunteers? Really relied on their work?
Largely. Sometimes underestimated, especially by management at various companies that I've worked for. People tend to try to say, "Oh, we need something done for you know, we want to contribute to Mozilla." Maybe some company comes along and says, "We want to make this change," and they go to Mozilla Corporation. They say, "We want to make this change," and Mozilla Corporation's like, "Well, you know, they have only so many people. They have only so much time, and there's slowness involved there. And people don't always understand that the way to contribute is actually just to go and contribute to the open source project, to become a member of the community, prove yourself in that world such that, or make your patches there, get people to review them, get them approved, and just go directly to the source. People think the source is going to be Mozilla Corporation or Netscape, but that's actually not effective. And it turns out that there's so many contributors in the outside of these companies who are maybe not full-time contributors, but they're nonetheless part of what keeps the thing going, that it's sort of a mistake to not see them as so important and so much a part of it. I don't know if that's really answering your question.
Yeah, no. But I sort of following on from that. Why do you think those people who come in? Why do you think they think the right thing to do is go to Mozilla Corporation rather than
join
the community?
Because people like to have an entity to go to. They like to have a company to go to. They like to have an engineering director to go talk to.
Mm-hmm.
people like that kind of structure so that they can get promises. They can know that there's some, you know, organization in that way. But you know, a lot of the work gets done by people who are outside of those organizations. And that work can be very small, from helping to triage bugs to raising alarms when certain problems occur. I see a huge, so go down a slight tangent. Here at Google, working on software, I think there's a great engineering process in place here. However, in some ways, it doesn't have the kind of testing that Mozilla has, where when we put in a change, if it broke some obscure configuration, something very obscure, we'll hear about it the next day or the next week, because there's so many people who are involved grabbing the snapshots every day testing. Whereas here at Google, when we put out a change, it could completely, you know, I'm talking about like a client product, it could affect some obscure configuration and we won't hear about it until after we release. And then we have to backpedal and do a lot more work. That's a huge difference, I feel. And I feel like with Firefox, we're able to be a lot more confident that we've sort of dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's before the release comes, because when we put out an alpha release, we get hundreds and thousands of people downloading it, and it's just tremendous.
Why do you think people volunteer?
Oh, I think it's that they care about the product. Like, I think a lot of people volunteer on Firefox in particular because of the relevance of the product. You know, they want. Oh, I got involved because I got involved and I was attracted to Mozilla because, as a college kid, I was using the Linux desktop, and I felt like this was amazing that I could use this. And the only reason I liked it, this is a real tangent, but I think it's relevant. I was running MATLAB at school in the lab on these Unix systems, and it meant I had to go to the lab, sit down, and do my work there. Somebody in the lab said, hey, look, if you install Linux, you can run MATLAB at home. This was before MATLAB released a version for Windows. Or maybe they had released a version for Windows, but it was very crappy. It didn't compare to the version for Unix. And MATLAB being into open source themselves, they went and released the Linux version, and it worked really well. And so I was compelled to install Linux at home and run MATLAB at home, and then I was able to get my schoolwork done so much faster. And so I thought, this is incredible. This Linux thing has saved me so much time. And then the only thing is, though, that kind of the browser on Linux wasn't so great, and I was using Netscape 4, and Netscape wasn't really doing anything with Netscape 4 at the time. And, you know, if you're on Windows, you could get an Internet Explorer. It's a much better browser. And so the idea of, like, making a browser for Linux that would work so much better than...
What year was this?
96, 97, 98, that time frame. I mean, Linux was very immature at the time, but it was enough so that I could run MATLAB. I mean, getting graphics working in Linux at that time, 96, was very not easy. It was very tedious, but there were some fellow in the lab at school who was very keen on helping, and so introduced me in that way. So personally, before I even got involved with Mozilla, I started working on an open source project of my own that was something for the GNOME desktop that would allow me, it was like Quicken for Linux, for GNOME, because I hated having to reboot into Windows to do Quicken. This was before online banking. You know, now I just do online banking and I don't care about Quicken anymore. So I wanted to write some code that would do this, and I thought, I'll just release it open source. This was when SourceForge had just gotten started, and I put my project out on SourceForge. It's like number 102 or something like that. So this was my introduction to open source, and I was so blown away by the fact that 2,000 people downloaded it in 1 week. I thought that was the most amazing thing, you know? And it's nothing compared to what Mozilla gets, but I thought that, why would everybody else cared about it, I guess, you know? Or these other people, and then some guy in Italy started contributing patches, and then some guy in France started contributing patches, and then, you know, that was so exciting. It got me really hooked. And so then that's why when I went to work for AOL and I knew that I could come to the West Coast and work on an open source project, I left out that detail. It was an open source project that really attracted me to it. And in particular, trying to make the Linux desktop better really attracted me to it. I mean, now I run Windows on my laptop, but I think that's sort of because I'm so frustrated with trying to run Linux on my desk, on my laptop, gave up.
So I understand that during the early development of Firefox, the CVS access was restricted to sort of a small group of people. Why was that decision
made? So Firefox, the application layer of Firefox was restricted. I wasn't part of that group. And so basically, the way I understand it was that, you know, Ben and a few other folks, they decided that they were... See, in some ways, Firefox was a revolt from the Mozilla process. And I know people in the Mozilla world don't like hearing that. But I think it's kind of true, because it was a revolt not only from the Netscape process, but also from the Mozilla process, which had too many cooks in the kitchen. Both, really. And not enough emphasis on just, we're going to build a good app. And a tight team could do that. And the tight team, Ben Goodger, and folks, David Hyatt and Blake and Brian Reiner and other people who were just very focused on, look, we're going to just build a really simple browser. It's not going to have all these crazy bells and whistles that Netscape product had. And we're not going to let anybody else try to come in and sort of say, no, you have to have this piece of UI there. I'm sure Ben probably talked about some of this. But I think it worked very well for sort of bootstrapping this effort, because somebody had to do that. Somebody had to rock the boat and say, no, look, guys, we're doing it all wrong. And at that time, whenever they tried to say, look, guys, we're doing it all wrong, nobody wanted to hear it. And I think that this was good, because, you know, it sort of takes some sort of something that goes really against the grain to sort of make change. And now we're sort of at a turning point where we don't want that sort of closed development model for Firefox. Again, I'm only talking about the application layer. Meanwhile, the back end platform was developed in the same way it always had been, in a very sort of very open way, with a different hierarchy. But since Firefox was done on the side, and when it started to appear like this was the way to go, then people started getting behind it, but somewhat reluctantly. A lot of the reluctance of the Mozilla community to get behind Firefox initially had a lot to do with the fact that the people who started Firefox were so going against the grain in terms of process. And
does that sort of difference in process still exist?
Not as much. And trying to arrive at a new process, basically, that's good for Firefox, that's good for Thunderbird, that's good for the Mozilla community, because it's, you know, people move on. Dave Hyatt left to go to Apple. Blake's not really involved anymore. And so it's important to bring in fresh blood and make it easy for fresh blood to get involved, because some of the best contributors lately have been new people. And new people are sort of the lifeblood of any project, because people get burnt out. And people who are sufficiently compelled to be new people usually have something that they really want to do. And that passion is something really important to tap into. So I think it's good that we're moving towards a direction that tries to sort of open Mozilla more, open Firefox development more, make it easy for new people to come in. Ben and I are seeing firsthand how hard it is for new people to get involved, you know, just by looking at our coworkers here at Google, who are also trying to contribute. Some of them are trying to contribute directly to Firefox, but finding it to be quite an overwhelming project.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think Mozilla, but particularly Firefox, has been able to attract so many users?
Because it's simple, and it just focuses on being a good browser. And it gets that part right. You know, it doesn't, you know, it just works. You know, that's like the thing that people want. I mean, my wife said to me the things she wished that they would fix with Firefox is make printing work better. I didn't care about any other bells and whistles. Just wants to be able to have a reliable product. You know what I mean? And that's what Microsoft did well. And they blew the pants off Netscape, because IE worked really well. And of course they had market advantage and all that kind of thing, but I think it was a better product. Netscape wasn't building a better product at that time. I mean, Netscape crashed. Netscape had all these issues, in my experience. And so, you know, it's really important for Firefox to be something that people view as a rock solid product that they can depend on, because then they'll use it.
Maybe you could just briefly explain the relationship between Google and Mozilla. And
so Google's just about trying to help Firefox succeed. That's our team's mission. Like, what can we do to help Firefox succeed? You know, throw some people at it to work on developing it. Help them market Firefox. You know, whatever we can do. You know, help them. You know, like for instance, I think we do this thing where we bundle the Google Toolbar with Firefox, and we encourage people to point users at that, and if they do, they get some sort of benefit. I don't know the details of how it works, but it's sort of our effort to sort of help people find out about Firefox, you know, to get the word out, encourage people to market it for us. Things of that sort. I think that, so our relationship with them is more of a, how can we help?
And how do people at Google, other people at Google not working on Mozilla products, not working on Firefox,
mm-hmm.
see the people who are working, sort of the Firefox group?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, some people see it as, wow, this is great. You know, now we have a resource, like, you know, if I'm building a web application, like, you know, somebody who works on Gmail will come and say, help me, I don't understand why this doesn't work in Firefox or something, you know, and then we can help give them some insight, or in turn, we can learn about the kinds of things that are causing Gmail and Maps headaches. You know, people who are building these complex web apps often run into barriers with the browsers, and that's really important feedback for us as browser producers to know about, you know, to help us understand what things do we have to do to make the platform more stable or better so that these things like Google Maps work better.
And how would you characterize the relationship between people who are sort of kind of on the inside, either at Mozilla Corporation or kind of closely associated, like across the street, and kind of the larger community, the outside, kind of volunteer community? How does that work? Are there resentments? Is it?
I think that there's not too much resentment. I think that there's, I think that, you know, people on the outside have sort of been asking for more transparency in decision making, or at least more information about how decisions are arrived at, and so recently we've been trying to make being at Google, being on the outside, if you will. We're able to, and having a lot of coworkers who are totally new, sort of able to see where people get stuck. Like, my product manager didn't understand which mailing list he needed to be on, you know, in order to understand what was going on with Firefox 2. And this was, even though Mozilla sort of posted on a wiki, it's like, how are you supposed to find that wiki? How is somebody supposed to know that that's there? And if they miss one email where it was mentioned, they're kind of lost forever. And you can't just go to the Mozilla homepage and say, okay, I want to find out what's going on with Firefox 2 development. Where the hell do you go? And so it requires people who already know to tell you. And so that's a problem. And so otherwise, though, I'd say that there's a lot of working together with the community. Like, we'll have meetings. The Firefox 2 product meeting is completely open to anybody who wishes to attend. I've had a lot of people don't know that. Similarly, we have meetings where we discuss things for the platform, and routinely people who are in the community are invited to attend. And so I think the biggest problem is just sort of that initial sort of ramping up. How do you find out where things are? How do you figure out where to go, who to talk to? That's the problem, if there's any problem.
Kind of more, just very briefly, because we got to go. How would you define a successful open source project? I mean, what elements and practices do you see that are necessary for developing a successful project?
Wow, there's a lot of things. Well, I think it's important that the process be open, not just in source, but also in process and development, meaning that it's, like we've been saying, that it's open for new people, because that's so important, getting new people. It's important that people... it's important that sort of the design decisions are open so that you know, they can be critiqued in advance of a product release. It's important that you're building the right product, or building a product that actually fits some need. Sometimes open source projects are just sort of a developer's toy pet project that they just wanted to do, and it's not. And so that's great, and that fits a lot of needs, and is great. But it doesn't always. But if you're trying to build something that's large scale, that's like Firefox, I think it's really important that the community be focused on what they're building. You know, all, at the end of the day, we're not building Gecko. We're building Firefox. That's what users are going to use. And people are going to say, well, did Firefox work well? People are going to say, did they're going to tell their friends to go use Firefox. They're not going to tell them to go use Gecko.
And just last question. What do you think the popularity of Firefox will do for the open source movement as a whole, and where do you see the future of open source?
Well, I think it indicates that open source projects can be wildly successful. I mean, this one is very successful. Even though we only have 10% of the user base or whatever the number is, that's huge. That's got to be the most successful open source project in that regard, you know, in terms of just sort of the number of users that it's touched. Of course, there's other projects that are wildly successful too, Linux and you know, server-side stuff. Open source is very successful, but that's because it's tech-minded people who are adopting it in that world, and that's a much easier audience to tap into. So I think that Firefox is great for, like, sort of paving the way in a way for other things like OpenOffice, you know, and other consumer-oriented projects, because it shows that you can build a successful consumer-oriented product in an open way. A lot of times product people, they feel like they need to have tight control over everything in order to build their product, especially if it's something that's user-facing. They don't want to relinquish control to people in the community, but it's not really about relinquishing control. In the Mozilla world, people who are, you know, control is granted based on merit, and we want to welcome dissenting opinions about what we're doing as much as possible, so we can know what the best thing to do is, you know. So hopefully Firefox is sort of an example of how an open source project can be a successful consumer product, or can be used to generate a successful consumer product.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
This was really great. And just very, very quickly, is there anybody sort of that we should talk to that we probably don't already know about, you know, like we kind of know the names of the key people, the, you know, kind of.
So I know that you're interested.
The 20 people you'd think we'd
right.
know about, but is there anybody who'd like have an interesting story
sure.
that really won't get told otherwise?
So I don't know if Aaron Boodman's on your list.
I don't know.
He's a Googler who wrote Grease Monkey.
Okay.
Oh, I don't think I. Yeah.
You've
yeah,
heard
okay.
of Grease
yeah,
Monkey?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I don't think
and
we.
He works in our team. He is.
How do you spell it?
BoodMan. I'm sure he'd have interesting stories to tell about his perspective of Firefox, being that he came, you know, he used to work at Microsoft. He got excited about Mozilla because he could build Grease Monkey and all the various other things. So I bet he'd have a lot of interesting stories for you.
Great.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.